Going to give that a moment. You know, pretty soon we won't have to listen to that. We're going to work on that. But today I want you to capture the emotion that you experience when something or someone precious is lost. In case you're having trouble calling that to mind, I want to give just a couple of examples to try to jog your thinking. When Kim and I were just a few years into marriage, I lost about 20 pounds, and my wedding ring didn't fit right anymore. It was very loose. And before I could have it resized, we went home to Tennessee to spend the holidays with my folks and was outside with a bunch of family members on a chilly evening just before sundown, playing football in the backyard, and ran out to catch a pass, lunged with my left arm, and you know, as soon as I did, my wedding ring just went sailing through the air. I did the best I could on hands and knees to find it, but it was getting dark very quickly, and I couldn't find it. Now, just capture that feeling for a moment. Not the one where I was afraid of being in the doghouse for 3 nights. That's a different one. Capture that feeling of panic, right? Thinking this thing that's precious to me, that reminds me of one of the most special days of my life, is gone. I'm never going to find it in the grass. You've probably had a similar experience of some kind. You can probably also appreciate the relief I felt when Kim came out with a flashlight and managed to find it pretty quickly. That was a really special moment. But I want you to capture those emotions today. The panic, the desperation that you feel when something precious is lost, and the relief that you feel when it's found. Let me take it up a notch. My friend Kelly, who I went to college with, lives in Texas. And last summer, she took her two young girls to go swimming at a community pool with friends. When they finished swimming, she went to the car and strapped the girls into their car seats in the minivan, put the keys in the ignition, and then noticed that there was someone standing on the sidewalk who appeared to need help. And so she walked over to ask if she could help. And before she even knew what was happening, a woman got into the driver's seat of her van with the keys there and took off with her little girls. All she could do was watch. She had no way to chase after them. She had no clue who this was who just took off with her children, or if she would ever see them alive again. Now capture that emotion for a moment. That sense of panic, the fear, the desperation. Thank God the police came quickly, sent out the units to canvass the area, helicopters, and within a short time they found the van, they found the girls safe and unharmed inside, and all ended well. And of course, Kelly, when she was reunited with them, collapsed to her knees in tears, just embracing them in the sheer relief. You can probably appreciate that emotion as well. I'm asking you to capture that two-sided emotion this morning, the feeling of desperation when something precious is lost and the absolute relief when that something is found, because that's what Jesus did when he wanted to show people the very heart of God, and specifically, what makes God happy. If you can capture that emotion and what Jesus says about it, you're going to get a very clear glimpse of how he feels about you and what he wants for this church community. Today is the last day of the sermon series that Bob mentioned a moment ago, At the Table. And the occasion that I'm referencing this morning is prompted by Jesus' dinner habits, and specifically the kind of company that he kept, the people that he ate with at meals. I'd love for you to open a Bible so that you can see what we're talking about. We're going to be in Luke chapter 15. And if you don't have a Bible with you, you're welcome to use the one in the pew rack in front of you. You can find this on page 1625. Luke 15, and if you look at verses 1 and 2, you'll see what I'm talking about. Luke writes, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" Jesus' reputation is taking a hit because of the kind of people that he has dinner with. We've been seeing this over the last few weeks. Jesus is eating his meals, reclining around a table, perhaps like this one, with hated people. People like the chief tax collector from last week, Zacchaeus, or that promiscuous woman we saw a few weeks back who was well known in her town for doing all the wrong things. Jesus even has an avowed racist in his inner circle, Simon the Zealot. This is not the kind of company that you want to keep if you're going to be running for office. I mean, Jesus, really, if you want to be a public figure, this stuff's going to come back to bite you later on. You got to get rid of these kind of people. And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law are the moral guardians of the culture. They're the ones who've been trying to purify God's people from all the evil influences, and they're saying, hold on a minute, we've been trying to get people to stay away from the dirty types because we don't want our people to be contaminated, and now he's inviting them back in. People are following him. This is not a good thing. This has to stop. And that is the moment when Jesus does what I mentioned before. He tries to get his diverse audience from religious leader to riffraff to capture the emotion that we all feel when we lose someone or something precious. Because if they can capture that, they're going to understand exactly how God feels about lost people. So Jesus tells three quick stories to help them capture the emotions. He starts off by talking about sheep, because unlike us, most people in his audience can understand sheep. And he says, you know, imagine that you own 100 sheep. They're your livelihood, your living depends on them, but you also love them because you spend every moment of every day caring for them, and they become like pets. You know them each by name. Well, one day, one of those sheep wanders away from the flock and gets lost. You have no clue where it is. What would you do? Of course, you would leave the 99 who never got lost, and you would go wherever you have to find the one lost sheep. And everybody in Jesus' diverse audience is nodding. Yeah, we know how that works. That's what we would do. And he says, what would you do when you find it? You would put it on your shoulders and carry it back and throw a party because you're so happy that you found that sheep. And everybody's saying, yeah, that's right. That's exactly how it works. And then Jesus makes his point. That's exactly how God feels when someone he loves is wandering far from him. He's so desperate for them to come back that he'll go looking for them. And when he finds them, God throws a party in heaven. But then Jesus takes a slightly different approach in case they can't appreciate sheep. He says, think about a woman, maybe your own mother or another widow, somebody who doesn't have anybody else around to take care of her. She lives on a very small fixed income, barely getting by month to month. And the way that she pays her bills is at the beginning of the month, she gets whatever money she has and she puts it in envelopes. You've heard of that system before. Puts some cash in this envelope and some in that one so that when the time comes to pay each bill, she has the amount that she needs. And lo and behold, the day comes when she has to pay the electric bill. Of course, I'm taking some liberties here to make this a little more modern, so bear with me. The day comes to pay the electric bill, and she goes to find the $100 that she stashed away for that, and she checks the hiding spot where it's supposed to be, and it's not there. And she's frantic. She looks in every corner of that house. She overturns every mattress and every pillow, every hiding spot she can think of. And finally, in one last act of desperation, she finds it in a shoebox tucked away in the closet. She had been thinking about how she would spend the next month in cold and dark if she didn't find that money. You know how it felt when she was panicking, and now you know how it feels when she's so relieved to have found it. She's going to call her neighbors together and throw a party. And Jesus says, that's exactly how God feels when someone he cares about is wandering far from him. He will do whatever he has to do to go and find them and bring them home. And when he has them, God throws a party in heaven. But then, just in case they're not getting it, Jesus tells one more story. And this one's going to be the arrow that goes straight to the heart. It's going to make his point in climactic fashion because it deals with the love of a parent for his children. you may be familiar with this story. In this one, Jesus talks about a father who has two sons. And he says, one day, the younger of those two sons comes to the father with a shocking request. It is a request that is both greedy and hurtful. The son says, Dad, I want my share of the estate, and I want it now. Now, things were different in those days. The estate was that father's financial security. There was no Medicare or 401k that was going to kick in his later years. The property, the land, and all that it produced, that was the man's financial stability into retirement. That was the family's hope for the future. And for him to give half of the estate to one of his sons means he would have to sell off half the land and its holdings and then give the money to the child. And this was an outrageous request. It amounted to the son saying, Dad, I wish you were dead. I don't care about you. All I want is your stuff. I want what's coming to me, and I want it now. The boy doesn't give a rip about his father. He only cares about his things. Nothing that the boy could have said would have been more hurtful than that. Give me my share of the estate. It violated every value of that community. Of course, the father would have had every right to be angry and reject the request, but in Jesus' story, that's not the way it goes. Jesus says that the father grants the request on the spot. He gives the boy what he asks for. And you can be sure that if word got out in the culture, in the community about what had happened, people would be outraged because this was just scandalous. You don't do this kind of thing. And everybody who's sitting around Jesus is getting closer because they're being drawn in, and the Pharisees are shaking their heads and going, outrageous. Can't believe it. So Jesus continues. This boy takes the money and goes off to a distant country, and he squanders all of the wealth. This is where he gets the name prodigal, if you know him as the prodigal son. The word prodigal means reckless, recklessly wasteful, extravagant, lavish. And he's called that because that's the way he lived when he went off to a far country. We're not told by Jesus exactly what he did. The older brother will accuse him of being with prostitutes, but we can be fairly certain he didn't blow his money on Diet Coke and video games. He's living a wild life, according to Jesus. But finally, as Jesus says, the young man comes to his senses. He realizes just how low he's sunk, how far he is from home. And it's not just that he's hungry and broke and humiliated, but he's also alone. Because all the people who wanted to be around when he had the money to party, they're gone now. And he finds himself in a pigsty with nothing to eat, dirty, cold, and alone. And he decides right then and there to head for home. Well, now the Pharisees are not so much shaking their heads anymore, but the other people sitting around Jesus, all the addicts and all the gamblers and the women of ill repute, are nodding their heads. They're saying, yeah, we've been there. We've done that. Got the T-shirt. You know what it's like. We hit rock bottom. They know that they're lost. In fact, that's why they're hanging out with Jesus. They're far from God. And the lost son in the story realizes how shameful, how hurtful he's been. So Jesus says he starts to prepare his apology speech. He's going to go home and he's going to apologize profusely to his father, admit what a fool he's been. He's prepared to work the rest of his life to pay off what he took and what he wasted. And so all the way home, he practices the speech, just hoping that his father will take him back at least as a hired hand, if not as a son. And now the Pharisees are nodding again and they're thinking, oh yeah, he had better beg. He better apologize on his knees. What the boy doesn't realize, and what the Pharisees don't realize, is that the father, in Jesus' story, has not been stewing. He's not waiting just to pounce on the boy when he comes home. Well, he's been waiting, but a different kind of waiting. He's been going to the window every day, straining his eyes, hoping against hope that he'll have the chance to hold his boy one more time, praying that the boy will finally come to his senses. Walking out to the edge of the property every day just in case. He's doing what so many parents, so many of you have done, praying for wayward children. And right now, everyone who's sitting around Jesus, Pharisees and sinners alike, everyone has captured the emotion of a parent separated from a child. They feel the desperation, the pain, the worry. Jesus has them right where he wants them. They're in suspense, waiting for what happens next. Well, Jesus says one day the father goes out just like he's been doing every day, And he goes to the hill at the edge of his property to look off in the distance, knowing that it's not likely, but hoping that just maybe the boy will be coming home. And as he looks way off into the distance, he sees a figure that looks a little bit familiar, and he thinks his eyes are playing tricks on him, but he looks closer, and the longer he looks and the closer the figure gets, the more he realizes, this is my boy. And he hikes up his long robes and he takes off running, which no respectable Jewish man would ever have done in public. And when he reaches the boy, it's all he can do to throw his arms around him and embrace him and collapse in tears because his boy is home. The reaction of the father would lead us to call him the prodigal father, because recklessly wasteful, lavish, extravagant, that's the kind of love that he shows the boy who comes home, which is surprising because this is the boy who has wounded him and his family deeply. This is irrational, outrageous love. Well, Jesus continues, the wayward son immediately confesses to everything. He admits that he's not even worthy to be called a son anymore. Offers to work his way back, to pay off everything he's taken. But the prodigal father says, no, that's not the way it's going to be. You are my son. You cannot earn your way back into this family, but I am making you a son and an heir once again. And the father brings out all the royal symbols of his acceptance. He brings out royal robes. He brings out a signet ring, which implies authority, implies inheritance. He calls for the fattened calf to be killed in a place and time where meat was expensive, and you kept the fattened calf for the most special of occasions. This is when he wants it. I mean, this is love beyond reason. And at this point, everyone is drawn in. They're into the emotion, the desperation, and the relief. And Jesus has made the point with power one more time that this is exactly how God feels. When someone he loves, the tax collector and the sleazy woman, when they're wandering far from him and they decide to come home, God is so desperate for them, he would have sent out a search party, but when they come back, he's so happy that he throws a party in heaven. This is the very reason that Jesus is spending time with the money launderers and the prostitutes and the other deviant people, because God cares so much about each person who is far from him, just as a parent cares for a wayward child. In fact, it was the reason Jesus had come, to rescue people like this. And this is the point where we expect Jesus to say, let's bow our heads and close in prayer. Let's go for coffee and bagels. Because he's driven home the point, climactically, a third time, like any good preacher would do. But this is not where Jesus stops. It's not the end of this story. And if we stop there, we're going to miss the heart of God. Jesus continues because he has a very surprising point to make with this third story. As is often the case with Jesus' parables, there's a twist at the end. You see, if you were to go back to the beginning of this one, in verse 11, where he started, you'll notice that Jesus started out by saying that this is a story of two sons, not just one. And the other son has a large role to play in the way that the story ends. If you look with me at verse 25, I'm going to read and we'll see what plays out. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Now keep in mind that Jesus made up this story. And he made it up and he told it in a very particular way to a particular audience to make a particular point. And what exactly does he bring out about this older brother in the way that the story ends? Well, he brings out that this was a hard-working young man. He's always played by the rules. He did things right, but when he hears about the party that's happening back at the house and how the father has rolled out the red carpet for the sinful brother, he gets so angry that he says, I'm not going in. Not if he's there, I will not be there. And he stays outside. Now, where does that leave him with respect to the father? Well, he's outside in the field and the father is inside at the feast. It leaves him alienated from the father. And you see what Jesus is doing here? Jesus is redefining what it means to be lost. You see, all the Pharisees and religious people sitting around the table, they would have understood that the tax collectors and the sinners, that they were lost. It was obvious. But they didn't have a complete definition of what it means to be lost. And so Jesus is expanding on that. He's redefining what it means. And what does it mean in this story to be lost? It means being alienated from the Father. It means being outside the feast when the Father is inside. You see, the chief good is being with the Father, enjoying relationship with Him, being at His feast with Him and His guests. The younger son in the story, he knows he's lost. When he's out in a foreign country starving to death in a pigsty with a hangover the size of Texas and an empty wallet, he knows how far he is from the Father. The sinner types who are hanging around him, they probably knew how lost they were too. They couldn't get away from it. But now Jesus shines a light on the older brother because he is equally cut off from the Father in the feast. When he says, hey, if little bro is inside, I'm not going in, he's remaining alienated from the Father. The thing that makes it worse is, he doesn't even know it. You see, the two sons have done exactly the same thing, only in very different ways. What did the younger son want at the outset exactly? Did he want relationship with the father? He wanted to just enjoy his dad? No, of course not. He wanted the dad's stuff. He wanted the money so that he could go off and discover himself and all the pleasures that the world has to offer. It's what we think of as lostness, licentious living, self-discovery, throwing off the rules, the Hugh Hefner kind of life, if you're watching the news this week. The more obvious kind of lostness. But now when it comes to the older son, what does he really want? Does he just want to enjoy relationship with the father? Is he happy that this is the best day of the father's life because the other son has come home? No, what does he want? He wants the father's things too. He's just trying to get him a different way. He's trying to get him by saying, I've lived a good life. I've kept all the rules. I've always played inside the boundaries. Now give me your things. You see, the difference is not in what they want, but in how they're going about getting it. Because I've always been a good boy, I've tried so hard, you owe me, he's saying to the father. He wants the same thing as the licentious boy wants. He's just trying to get it by being especially good. And his pride in doing good things has left him just as alienated from the father. See, most of us think about sin and being lost as kind of a set of commandments that people break. You know, if we do these things we're not supposed to do, then we're lost. We're separated from God. But Jesus shows us in this story that the essence of sin and the essence of being lost is being alienated from God because of our attempt at saving ourselves. Now, some of us try to save ourselves or justify our existence in all the obvious ways, running far from God, throwing off the rules. Others of us, though, have tried to save ourselves or justify our existence by doing all the right things, by keeping all the rules, and has left us, according to Jesus, just as cut off from God. We're not interested primarily in God for Himself, but in His things, His blessings. That if we can live a good enough life, if we can keep enough rules, if we can give away enough money to the poor, then God will owe us health and wealth and prestige and romance and safety, we feel. And we think that because we've played by the rules, that God will somehow be in our debt. He will owe us a good life and a ticket to heaven. But that leaves us just as alienated from the Father and His feast as the younger brother, only we're worse off because we don't even realize it. Now, think about what Jesus is doing here. In His context, the people sitting around Him, the story He's telling, who does the younger brother represent in His audience? Well, the sinners, the deviant people, the prostitutes, the tax collectors, and Who does the older brother represent in his audience? Well, obviously, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the religious leaders. Now, remember what prompted this whole thing. This whole storytelling session was prompted by those religious people muttering about who Jesus was eating with. Now, can you see why Jesus told them this story? Those religious leaders felt that by keeping every letter of the law in Scripture, they could maintain a favored position before God, and they didn't want to be contaminated by anyone. And they're refusing to come into friendship with Jesus because he is making friends out of these people who are flaunting their rules about purity. And Jesus is aiming this story right at the Pharisees' hearts because they don't even realize they're lost. Now that's the first twist at the end of the story. But you know what's so astonishing about this? Is there's kind of a twist within a twist at the end of this one. You see, the father in the story isn't satisfied just to have the younger brother back home, is he? No, even after he has the younger son back home, he goes out into the field to plead with the older brother. You see? He says, I'm not going to be happy unless both sons are sitting at my table together. The one who threw off all the rules and insulted the family, and the one who's played by the letter of the law. You see what Jesus is doing? It's mind-boggling. He is effectively pleading with the religious leaders sitting at that table, the people that we think he should be making his enemies. He is pleading with them to come into friendship with him and the people that he's welcoming, the obvious sinners, recognizing that they all have a seat at his table on equal footing only because he's inviting them. You see, the older son is not being portrayed as the villain, but as a son cherished by the Father. That's the way Jesus feels even about the religious people. I think Jesus is showing us in this story that the Father, God, and His feast belong to us, whether we've been religious or irreligious, as a free gift. It's not a message of morality or immorality, it's gospel. You have a seat at my table because of what I'm doing and what I'm going to do. It's the truth that we can be accepted by God because of the record of His Son and not because of anything that we've done. See, the good news for us today, because I know that some of us are older brother types and some of us are younger brother types, is that Jesus is pleading with us whichever position we find ourselves in. He's pleading with us, come into my feast. Come, accept my invitation. Let me change your heart. Now, let's just say for a moment that you happen to be a little bit more like the older brother, that you could identify with him when he got angry, that you've felt yourself saying, God, you owe me better than this. How can your heart be changed? I think it happens when you look at the radical vulnerability of Jesus Christ for you. If you see the end of this parable as not just a father in a story that's made up pleading with his son, but you see it as Jesus pleading with his enemies, because that's what he's doing. He's pleading with the people who are going to kill him. And he's not denouncing them. He's saying, my son, I know you've worked hard, but you don't understand the purpose of the Father. Don't you realize that everyone is lost and everyone is loved and everyone is invited to the table? And if you hear him doing that, pleading with you, your heart's going to start to be softened. You're going to see him on the cross saying, only because I'm hanging here do you have any hope. But because I'm here, you have a seat at the feast. And I'm glad to do it. You see, when you hear Jesus speaking to you the way that he's pleading with these religious teachers, these older brothers, it's going to melt you out of your spiritual condition. It's going to soften your heart. If you can capture the emotion of a father being separated from two sons and the relief of having them home, you're going to capture the heart of God. You're going to understand how he feels about you and what he wants for our church family. Because God is not happy if the licentious people are left out of the feast, the rule breakers, and God is not happy if the religious, hardworking rule keepers are left out of his feast. He wants both kinds of people at his table. And we have access to the table of Jesus, his friendship, figuratively now and literally his feast in the future, by invitation only. We're all invited guests. And here's what I want you to take away from today. Jesus is happy when we sit at his table as invited guests, delighting in all the other invited guests. Jesus is happy with us when we sit at his table as invited guests, delighting in all the other invited guests. Now that's going to mean a lot of different things about how we live, about how we extend friendship to people we're not normally comfortable with, about how we relate with people here at church. One of the things it's going to mean is that we can't be spiritual TSA agents. You know the TSA, right, at the airport? They're there to tell you all the things you can't bring in. And they're going to screen you, and if you happen to forget 4 ounces of water in your bottle, deep in your backpack, they're going to make sure you know you can't get on the plane until you either inhale it or dump it. Some of us tend to be spiritual TSA agents. Oh, yeah, sorry, you can't come in until you get rid of that thing, that habit, that part of your life. And if we understand what makes Jesus happy, we have to let that tendency go and say, Jesus invites you to his table. Once you come, he's going to start to make you new, but you're welcome here. You know, another thing that I think this is going to make, this is going to cause for us is this causes us to realize that we need to bend over backwards to accommodate people who are far from God and who are inclined to seek him. We need to bend over backwards in our relationships, in our neighborhood, in our work, but also means that we need to bend over backward to accommodate people here. And there's going to be a very tangible application of this in the very near future, because this motivation is what's behind all that we're doing to our building. We've already started some of it. You've seen some of the changes we've made in the commons and the foyer. And we hope that sometime this winter we're going to start doing that here in this room, which is precious to so many of us. And the motivation that drives all of that is being able to have a space where we encounter God that is as accessible and as welcoming as possible to people who have been far away from him. So that if they venture out in risk to come and seek him here because one of you invites them, they'll say, wow, I feel comfortable here. I can see myself belonging here. You know what that means? It means that all of us at some point are going to have to let go of some of our preferences for what we think this room should look like. And when we feel that discomfort and that tension, we're going to remind ourselves we're doing this to accommodate people at the table of Jesus who are far from him and whom he loves. Jesus is happy when we sit at his table as invited guests, delighting in all the other invited guests. Let's take a moment to pray. Lord, we started out the morning by singing, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. We are all prone to wander from you. God, some of us are prone to do it in the obvious ways, the self-destructive ways. Others of us are inclined to do it by our self-righteousness and our pride. All of us have found ourselves prone to wander from you. And Lord Jesus, we thank you that you came out looking for us. You left the feast to come and plead with us to come back in. Thank you for your great love that took you to such lengths. We remember you today, Lord, with thankful hearts, and we want these hearts of ours to be transformed by the experience of your love, to be less prone to wander, to cling to you. Let your grace, Lord, like a fetter, bind our wandering hearts to you. Amen.